worked on the classical limit. And so he's going to tell us about his approach to it, and then if Jess managed to find his notes, perhaps he'll have a few minutes at the end.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, great. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about this stuff. This is some old stuff I'm going to tell you about. I did my PhD on understanding the emergence of classicality from quantum mechanics, and in particular, studying it in the context of chaotic systems. Because it turns out when you look at chaotic systems, you see some very kind of non-trivial challenges for understanding the emergence of classicality that don't really appear if you just think about simple systems like the harmonic oscillator or anything like that. Okay, so let me just start by saying what Matt was hoping I would say, which is that when we talk about understanding the emergence of classicality, that the approach you use and the criteria you apply for indicating success depend on your interpretation of quantum mechanics. And now I'll try to make that clear, and then I'll focus on what that approach is and what those criteria are in the context that I favor, which is thinking of quantum states as incomplete information about physical reality. So what do we mean emergence of classicality? Well, we mean that we assume that quantum theory is valid on all action scales and mass scales. That the quantum effects that we see when we see deviations from classical theory, by which I mean, you know, Hamilton's equations of motion or any kind of classical formulation of mechanics, Lagrange, Newton, classical statistical mechanics, when we see deviations from this at the micro scale. So, you know, what do we know? Well, we know if you want to describe the hydrogen atom, it turns out that the energy levels are discrete rather than continuous. If you do a double slit experiment, you see this interference fringe emerge, which is a kind of a wave phenomena that particles shouldn't demonstrate according to classical mechanics. So if we assume that quantum mechanics is actually correct in the macroscopic limit, then we have to understand why these characteristic signatures of quantum mechanics aren't apparent. So we need a story or an explanation. Of course, an alternative approach, also inspired by interpretation, is the assumption that quantum mechanics actually breaks down on some mesoscopic scale. So there you have these dynamical collapse theories advocated by GRW and Philip Perl and others. Tony Leggett, a Nobel laureate, supports this idea that, because they're wrestling with this notion of superposition and the conceptual paradoxes it leads to under a particular interpretation of quantum mechanics, which I assume you've touched on to some degree. They say, well, look, this paradox is unresolvable, so let's just assume that quantum mechanics stops working at some mesoscopic scale, by which, you know, it would be, and it's unclear what that would be. We do know that experimentalists have pushed their ability to observe quantum effects in bigger and bigger systems on the mesoscopic scale in recent decades. And so, you know, the window of opportunity for those explanations is closing pretty rapidly. We know that you can create superpositions of macroscopic currents in a superconducting device. A decade ago, when I first gave this talk, it was recently. About a decade ago, Anton Zeilinger and his group demonstrated macroscopic superposition of a buckyball, which is a C60 atom, which is a pretty heavy particle. And I'll talk more about that in a minute to understand kind of, you know, why, how are they able to do that. So if you assume that quantum mechanics is correct, it must be the classical mechanics emerges in some limit. We have to understand some series of assumptions and approximations under which we can recover classical theory from quantum mechanics. One of the points I'll highlight to you is, you know, which classical theory do you expect to get? That's a really important question. And that's driven in part by your assumptions about the ontology of the wave function. Is the wave function a physical object? Is it, or is it incomplete information about the underlying physical properties of the world, aka hidden variables? So those are some of the issues that we'll struggle with. So let me just write down the main point, which is that your approach and criteria for a satisfactory demonstration that QM explains, adequately predicts macroscopic classical physics depends on your interpretational assumptions. So here we really see an instance. You know, often kind of interpretations of quantum mechanics is, you know, put down as being merely philosophical and so on. And I think nothing is further from the truth. I think that, for example, to answer a very important question like this, we need to think very carefully about interpretations. I think that to understand the power of quantum computing, we need to think very carefully about interpretations. I think to unify quantum mechanics with gravity, we need to think very carefully about interpretations to even know that we're going down the right path. So that's kind of my pitch for, I'm probably preaching to the choir since you guys get to select this course, but that's part of my own personal view about why it's valuable. Okay, so what are the kinds of assumptions? Well, if you go out and make a scientific conjecture, and this is not a scientific fact, if you conjecture that quantum states are physical, and you have things like, you explain things like the double slit by assuming that particles go through both slits at the same time and so on. You think Schrodinger's cat is simultaneously dead and alive until we observe it. If you conjecture the quantum states are physical and are led to those conclusions, you know, that introduces pretty serious issues, serious constraints, and unique problems into understanding the emergence of classicality. So I'm not going to talk much about this because I don't think it's right. But typically you have people that worry about a many worlds type interpretation, and then they have to concoct some story about how decoherence creates some multiplicity of classical trajectories. So, you know, I'm not an expert on this because, you know, I don't spend too much time working on problems that I don't think are well motivated. But this is an important program. And in fact, it's probably, I would say, the most popular view amongst physicists. So I would put myself in a minority camp. So, you know, follow me at your own peril. I mentioned already kind of dynamical collapse. So here, dynamical collapse, of course, isn't really an interpretation of quantum mechanics, but it's a modification to the Schrodinger equation. So it's a different scientific theory and not just a different interpretation. Modification of the Schrodinger equation. And there you need some mechanism to account for this, and it's pretty clear or somewhat clear how you get a story about emerging trajectories. Another important point is do you believe in objective reality at all? Okay, so you know, what is our end game here? You know, if anyone who's read Descartes realizes that you can make a pretty serious philosophical case that all we really know about is our subjective experience. And we, you know, there's like a chasm or a gap to actually, you know, you kind of reach out outside yourself and make this assumption that my direct experience is triggered by external events that are external to me. And those are what explain my experiences. Of course, that's not necessarily the case. You could be a mind in a vat, something like that. You could take an extreme, I think what's called a solipsistic point of view, which is that you are the only person that exists and everything else is a figment of your imagination. You know, for example, or you can follow quantum Bayesianism, which I think kind of leads to the same conclusion as solipsism. I've yet to see a satisfactory explanation of how it's not solipsistic. But you can take various kind of solipsistic views. I doubt I'll spell this right, because I don't think I've written this word out in a decade. Two L's or one. Solipsistic view, which is essentially there's no need to explain. There's no external reality that requires explanation. Because that I also reject. Okay, so these three stories, four stories, I don't think any of them are right. So I'm interested in the following. I'm making the following assumptions. Yes, there is an external reality. Moreover, I will claim that that consists of properties that are more or less accurately described by Newtonian mechanics. Consists of properties that are, you know, basically that are roughly or even quite precisely described by Newtonian mechanics. Of course, there can be exceptions. I mean, obviously, right away, GR corrections in Newtonian mechanics are going to be a problem. So that's why I mean roughly.
You mean in the everyday world, right?
Yeah, in everyday world. Thank you. That's an important caveat. All right, I hope I haven't lost too many of you yet. My second assumption is that there should be mathematical elements in our fundamental theory that correspond to those physical elements. So this is still consistent with the many worlds point of view. It's still consistent with dynamical collapse, and it's not consistent with this. So we're removing this one from these assumptions now. Rather than make further assumptions, let me just start telling you about the kind of the scientific results which kind of lead me to feel comfortable in these positions. What's the optimal thing here? I push the rear up. And I bring the front down. Okay, let me consider another nuance. You might have the view that, yes, external reality exists but I only expect quantum mechanics to describe my experience of it. This may be the story of quantum Bayesianism, but I'm not sure. It is? Because in this case, it's saying, it's what this is saying, and then if that's the case, then I would say quantum Bayesianism is somehow trivial. But here the point is we're not expecting elements of the theory to correspond to elements of reality. I'm just expecting elements of the theory to correspond to my own experience. Now, we already know that we can formulate quantum mechanics as an operational theory, and that you talk about the outcomes you observe. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, I think Chris himself attributes his ideas to Bohr, right? So the point is we have this personal experience, we just want quantum mechanics to describe it. So remind me if I forget, but in this point of view, we have an adequate account of classical chaos. So in this view, there is an adequate account of the emergence of chaos from quantum theory, where I want to understand the trajectories that these particles follow. I want to understand that under my own continuous observation of the particle. And this story, this account has been described by Habib and coworkers. And if we're happy with that, then essentially we're done. So what I'm going to be addressing is an account that addresses the second assumption, that there are these objective properties, and I want my theory, my fundamental theory, to provide some account, some story about what's going on, and not merely some story about my observations. Any questions yet about the way I'm dividing up the pie here? Any violent objections? That's weird. Don't be shy. I mean, come on. This should be a dialogue, by the way. So surely I've said something that either you guys all love this so much, you have no criticism. Just feel free. Just throw it at me.
I don't understand quite. Like, you're saying there's an external reality, but then you say that all I can expect to know by physical theories is my experience. So I don't know, I find it a little bit like those assumptions are contradictory.
Yeah, okay, so
is that gonna come into your, like, how is assumption one gonna come into your interpretation of emergence?
Under this view, that I just wanted, this one?
What does assumption one even mean if you can't observe it anyway?
Yeah.
It's like saying there's like, I don't know, like there's a certain horizon that we can never see behind, and like you can make any statement you want about that. Yeah, there's like green people living there. Sure, you can say that, but who cares?
No. You're missing my point. Okay, we're going back to the 17th century here. Okay, so what Descartes said is, I see a chair. Do I see a chair because there is a chair there objectively, or is it just that my mind is in a vat and some scientist has plugged, you know, the Matrix. I mean, this was the Matrix before the Matrix. I'm a mind in a vat and some scientist has plugged wires into my mind that make me think I'm seeing a chair there. So what I'm saying is I'm rejecting that second assumption. I'm saying the reason I see a chair there The reason I see a chaotic trajectory is because there is a particle that exists outside of me, and my experience is a reflection of that reality, rather than my experience being a figment of imagination. So I'm not advocating that we're assuming there are green aliens on the other side of the moon, even though we can't see them. I'm saying the things that I do see are explained by the existence of an external reality.
Is that a scientific statement or just a way you like to think about the universe?
I'm just setting the bar for myself. I'm saying, look, I'm going to assume, I'm interested in...
But why do we have to assume anything about whether a chair is really there or not? What does it even mean to be there or not? Like,
here's why. Because quantum mechanics, you pick an observable, and quantum mechanics specifies its eigenvalues, and quantum mechanics tells you the probability of seeing that eigenvalue. Quantum mechanics doesn't tell you there is an eigenvalue that exists. Newtonian mechanics imagines a physical reality, and it is a mathematical explanation of that physical reality. Quantum mechanics is a user manual, okay? It just says, I push this button on the microwave, and the light turns on in the oven. It's not making any claims about circuitry inside the microwave, or there's some little person in there that goes and turns on the light when I press the button. Quantum mechanics doesn't make claims about what's happening inside the box. It's a user theory. I press buttons on a box, certain lights light up.
But still, you make that statement because you want to give an interpretation to quantum mechanics. So I'm just asking whether it's a scientific interpretation or purely philosophical, but the way you want to think about the universe.
Well, this is clearly a philosophical statement, but it has implications on our scientific approach to understanding the emergence of classicality. So let me just make it concrete. There is a Newtonian trajectory that describes the moon's path around the Earth. Do I expect quantum mechanics to give me an account of that, or do I only expect quantum mechanics to say that whenever I look up at a certain point, I will see light reflecting off of the moon, but I'm not going so far as to say that the moon is there? That's the difference. Okay, well, you know what?
Is it a falsifiable statement?
This piece?
Yes.
Wait.
I know.
Well, I guess no,
it's
not.
Definitely philosophical, but is it purely philosophical? It's purely the way you like to think about the universe, or does it actually have scientific implications?
Well, I think it has scientific implications.
Well, perhaps if Joe explains how he's going to use it in his calculation, it'll become clear.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I work through this example, it'll become a little bit clearer, but I agree, this is a deep question, and we should... You know, I didn't prepare this where I spent like 10 hours thinking of what the right word for each sentence was, like I would do for a paper, okay? This is just a very kind of cavalier overview, and there's going to be confusions because language is not perfect. So it's good that we have discussions like this, but let me clarify, like Matt said, where I'm going with this through examples, and then I think it'll be clear why I'm making this distinction. All right, so probably now is a good time to actually do some math. So I'm going to run out of time. So rather than beat up on decoherence and superposition, let me just get right to the main results. Okay, so first we look at, you know, there's Ehrenfest's theorem. Did that was covered?
Yeah.
Perfect. So you know Ehrenfest's theorem. So the conclusion is that if the wave packet, and I just want to make sure that I just state it in my own words, if the wave packet is narrow enough, then the quantum expectation values follow to good approximation a classical trajectory. So the quantum expectation value, these are Newtonian coordinates. So these are time-dependent expectation values. And so one can assume, and the condition for this happening basically is that the wave packet is narrow enough relative to some, I can check on my slides, but you want the wave packet to be narrow with respect to some kind of variation in the potential. I think this has to be an inverse or something. Anyways, does that look roughly right? Anyhow, you expand you guys saw this. Let me not write down things when I don't check that they're correct. But the point is you want the wave packet to be narrow, and then this is true. So that looked like a pretty adequate account of how we get classical mechanics from quantum mechanics. You kind of avoid all the questions about superposition because you're assuming by fiat that the wave function is narrow. But what's interesting is now we look at classical chaos. And of course, classical chaos is described by, I haven't looked at this stuff in years, so let me get my cheat sheets. So we have sensitivity to initial conditions. In fact, it's an exponential sensitivity. And so you define, as a function of time, some distance metric between two trajectories, trajectories A and B. And you find that heuristically, this difference grows exponentially in time, where lambda is the Lyapunov exponent, describing kind of the strength of the instability. And then you say, OK, that's great. That's classical chaos. Now what we can do is we can look at quantum systems we can take some classical Hamiltonian, that is classified as chaotic by measuring its Lyapunov exponents. Okay. And then we can look at the quantized version of that Hamiltonian, the quantum Hamiltonian H of Q hat, P hat, T, with the same functional form. And we can ask, what kind of properties does the quantum system have when the classical system associated with the dequantized Hamiltonian is chaotic? And what you find numerically in a huge number of systems, or I think the correct pronunciation now is huge, in a huge number of systems we study numerically, you find that the width of the quantum wave packet, this is of course the good old square root of q squared minus q squared, you find that this object grows exponentially roughly at twice the classical Lyapunov exponent. What this means is the very assumption we made to get quantum mechanics quantum states to follow classical trajectories breaks down on a very short time scale set by the inverse of the Lyapunov exponent. So on a time scale, TB, which goes as 1 over lambda inverse times the log of essentially some macroscopic scale of interest divided by, this is a length scale, divided by kind of your initial wave packet size, is a macroscopic length scale. The quantum trajectories do not reproduce the classical trajectory. Sorry, this is a very lazy notation here. The point is, this very nice result starts to fail in a significant way. So it was actually Wojciech Zurek who pointed out that there's an interesting kind of case study for this. He considered Hyperion, which is a moon of Saturn, with a chaotic tumble. It's a pretty small moon. It's just like a giant rock. I guess most moons are. And it has a chaotic tumble. And in particular, given its Lyapunov exponent and so on, he showed that on a time scale of roughly 20 years, its wave packet will be spread out over some very large macroscopic length scale associated with its orbit. So we're talking kilometers. So now this is a problem if you assume that quantum states are physical, because all of a sudden the physical object, the quantum state, rather than being a narrow wave packet reproducing my trajectory, now it's spread out over kilometers. But yet whenever an astronomer looks in a telescope, it definitely sees the moon in some specific location, much like Schrodinger's cat. So the story here is that, so here the assumption, so first let me just clarify something. The claim is that we need decoherence to get an adequate explanation of the classical limit. That's the claim Zurich makes, and that is just not true. So the assumption is, if quantum states are physical, then yes, Zurich is right. We need a decoherent story to explain the emergence of classicality. If quantum states are physical, but the only problem is Zurich just forgot to mention the assumption, and just, you know, it's a good way to get published in good journals, by the way. Then we need a decoherent story. But because most physicists assume quantum states are physical, you can get away with just not making that assumption clear. So I've beat up Zurich about this on many occasions. So Zurich's initial argument, which he now concedes was wrong, yes?
How was that calculation done? Like, was it just like simply saying that the moon is a particle of mass m and stuff like that? Like, isn't that kind of a bit, I don't know, sketchy?
Yeah, sure.
So, like, well, shouldn't that result like not be taken too?
Well, like, it's an extrapolation. Like, I doubt he obviously didn't do an exact calculation. But what you do is you say, look, this is a heuristic. We find that when the system has a Lyapunov exponent, it typically the quantum mechanical description gives you this. People have measured the Lyapunov exponent for Hyperion, and so just by setting a threshold at which the width of the wave packet reaches some length scale you care about, which is this L quantity, then you can compute 20 years based on those numbers.
But like, if the wave packet becomes significantly non-zero, like far away from the expectation value of the position, like, we it's not like we look at Hyperion and like it collapse its wave function and it's like it's in somewhere different than we would have predicted from its classical trajectory. Like, or no, is it the point that we can't do that test because it's chaotic? Like, you know what I mean?
No, I think his argument is one of these, if we didn't observe it and if we didn't have decoherence, then the moon of Hyperion would be in a super macroscopic superposition over kilometers. Mm-hmm. That is the argument. But of course it's not, and his explanation for why it's not, or that we don't observe any unusual features of the moon's dynamics, he assumes that's because of decoherence and because we're observing it. So his argument, it's very much a Schrodinger's cat argument here. So there's not really anything novel conceptually beyond the Schrodinger's cat argument. The piece that's novel technically, is it in the Schrodinger's cat argument, you have an interaction between, you know, the radioactive counter which produces the electron in superposition of being emitted or not emitted, which then triggers the kill device, the cyanide. You have this kind of interaction between those two systems. And so lots of people think of that as a measurement interaction. And so it's led a lot of people to speculate that it's something about the nature of measurement that kills coherence or whatever. But this just shows that just an autonomous system with which there is no interaction. In other words, you need an interaction to create this micro-macro interface between the electron and the cat. And people have looked at that as part of the problem leading to the paradox. But this chaos argument shows that no, you don't even need that. Chaotic dynamics can intrinsically generate macroscopic superpositions without invoking any kind of measurement interaction or anything like that. You just intrinsically get this macroscopic superposition phenomena. So, but I'll give you my answer and then we can revisit your concern.
So we're completely ignoring the fact that there's like a huge planet right next to it? I mean, what is an observer? What is measurement if not interaction with a huge thing?
That's fine.
You need consciousness to collapse a wave function?
Yeah, by the way, the same is true of the Schrodinger's cat. Like Schrodinger's cat, you get a superposition, you have this electron is or is not emitted. So let me call a 1, the electron is emitted, and that correlates with the cat being dead. Plus a 0 is the electron is not emitted, and then the cat is alive. And then people say, oh, we need to explain, your observation comes in to kill the superposition. But wait a minute, as soon as you trace out the electron, you've already collapsed the cat into a mixed state, right? If I were just talking about the cat state alone is already a decohered superposition of dead and alive just by virtue of its interaction with the electron.
What do you mean tracing out means collapsing? Tracing out is a mathematical thing, right? Not a physical thing.
How come these guys don't know what tracing out means?
No, I know what tracing out means. I'm just saying it's a mathematical thing, not a physical thing. It's just me deciding to not look at the electron anymore.
Sure. I mean, so in the decoherence story, you imagine that this whole thing is actually correlated with other macroscopic systems as well. So when you trace out everything.
Yeah, which collapses stuff, but that's because it interacts with big stuff.
My point is this. Everything. Forget about the dust particles that are interacting with the cat. The very object which was necessary to trigger the superposition, when you ignore that, then you already have a mixed state. You don't need to talk about dust particles or whether Matt opens the box or not to explain why you have a mixed state. Like the mixed state emerges already just from the very definition of the problem. This is a minor point, so let's not worry about it too much. I'm just trying to say that this argument is a little bit cleaner than the Schrodinger's cat argument because in principle, there's no other system. And now your point is, but there are other systems. It's a three-body problem. It's, you know, there's all the planets in the solar system. But the point is, what we can do is we can approximate just like the reason why you, like when you do, if you want to describe an electron-proton system, the proton is much more massive than the electron. So effectively what you do is you reduce the problem to a fictional electron whose mass is rescaled by the mass of electron divided by the mass of electron plus a proton. And then you can treat in that center of mass system, you get some virtual point, which is the center of your reference frame, and a single body that's in orbit around that point. So the point is we can mathematically express the problem as a single body problem, and then we can look at the interpretation of that formalism. So that's what's going on here.
Yes, but there's still a potential there, and the electron and the proton are still interacting. And again, what is measurement if not interaction with a big thing?
I wouldn't say that's measurement at all.
What's measurement?
Measurement is when you have an observer who can do conditional actions based on some outcome. I would call that measurement. Just the fact that two things interact doesn't mean it's been measured. I think that's a crude description.
So you need consciousness for measurement?
No, you need an agent that can act in a conditional way. Otherwise, it's just an interaction. Otherwise, you can use the word measurement interchangeably with a coupling. In fact, there's a coupling. Well, I think you miss out on important nuances when you don't make that distinction, would be my argument. I mean, this is true even in classical probability theory. If you want to talk about conditional probabilities.
Doesn't everything act conditionally on stuff that it interacts with? If I put an electron here and one there, then like depending on how they interact, that electron is going to be in a different position or in a different state.
I love your cautious skepticism, but I think you're derailing the discussion at this point. So we can come back to that. All right, good. So the way in which this is characterized is that you would get something like the quantum expectation value minus the classical trajectory, that this deviation grows with the Lyapunov exponent. So the point is, if we look to Ehrenfest's theorem, we no longer have an adequate explanation of the emergence of classical trajectories. So I think this is a wrong-headed approach. So think about it. Our initial quantum state corresponds to some finite width in our uncertainty about the initial position of the quantum system. Okay, and so what we should consider is we should model our correct modeling of the situation classically. We should model this correctly in a way that takes into account our uncertainty about the initial position. This uncertainty. This is an empirical fact, right? I don't know the initial position to better than this. And so how do you do that? Well, fortunately, that problem was solved for us about 125 years ago. And Liouville said, how do we describe Newtonian systems or Hamiltonian systems when we don't have complete information about the initial conditions? And there he developed a formulation called Liouville mechanics. And how much of that have they seen? Good stuff. You guys are getting it now.
It's on the Liouville mechanics, right?
How many of you have never seen Liouville mechanics? How many of you have studied it for years? How many of you have some sense of what it is? All right. So basically, it's a theory that describes the evolution of probability density functions. So I have a probability density function which corresponds to my information about the position, about the coordinates, the position and momenta at some time t, and I want to know how does that density evolve in time. So what you get is the evolution in time, and so this is essentially what I studied in my PhD. The evolution in time is given by a partial differential equation, which is given by a Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian with the density. And this is true up to a minus sign, which I can never remember. And then there's a lot of beautiful things about this theory. First of all, this is a partial differential equation describing its time evolution. Okay, so this is a linear, continuous PDE for classical mechanics. The amazing thing is that if you think about this, you start out with some probability density describing my knowledge at some initial point in time, and then I let time evolve, and then this point evolves to this point, and this point evolves to this point, and this point evolves to this point, and then I get some shape, some new, the whole density moves to some new location. This is like a topographical, what's that called? A contour map for the thing. And then the evolution is symplectic because it's classical physics, which means that areas are conserved. Okay, so actually I didn't really draw it to scale very well because the area contained in here should be the same as the area in there. When you measure the system, now suppose I'm going to measure this system. Suppose I say, okay, now it's time t over here. I want to say, now I want to know, initially I didn't know, this was my initial lack of knowledge of the position and the momentum. This is phase space. And then at some later time, I say, okay, now where's my system now? Well, I didn't know where it was exactly, so I don't know where it is exactly later either. But because the shape can twist and bend and spread out, maybe a better example is to spread this out more so it's clearer that now all of a sudden my uncertainty can grow. So my delta Q of t is bigger. And in fact, my delta P of t can be bigger as well. but in such a way that the area is conserved. So think about a round shape becoming like a noodle. And now you're saying, well, wait, what are these delta Qs and delta Ps you're writing down? Well, it's the most obvious thing. Delta Q, we call it delta Q squared, would be the integral over dq dp of my phase space density at some time times q squared minus integral of dq dp of my phase space density at that time times q all squared. All right, so it's the classical expectation value of q squared minus the expectation value of q all squared. Before I tell you about how this reproduces quantum mechanics in the chaotic picture, let me also tell you a few neat things. People, when I started my PhD, the luminaries of the field of quantum chaos would say things like, oh, you can't have chaos in quantum mechanics because the Schrodinger equation is a linear equation and chaos requires nonlinear equations. True, but also not true, because the Liouville equation, if this is a chaotic Hamiltonian, and this is my equation of motion describing my knowledge about the system, even if I have a Hamiltonian that induces nonlinear equations of motion for the ontic particle, for the ontic properties, my equation of motion for the epistemic properties classically is a linear differential equation, irrespective of if it's chaotic or not. So that entire argument about how you can't have chaos in quantum systems is an argument that makes an assumption. It's a familiar assumption. It's this assumption. If quantum states are physical, then yes, you can't have quantum chaos. If instead you say, well, I'm not assuming quantum states are physical because I don't have to, then actually you say, well, there is a good analogy for class for quantum chaos. It's chaos at the level of epistemic Liouville mechanics. You get the same thing. Second thing, collapse of the wave function also exists in this theory. If I do a measurement, suppose I have some resolution of my ability to measure Q. So each of these corresponds to the resolution of my microscope in position based on, say, the wavelength of light I'm using. Classically, I can make this as small as I want. Quantum mechanically, I can make this as small as I want. But it's always going to be some finite threshold. I do a measurement. I get an outcome. The outcome is random. Sound familiar? Suppose it turns out it's in this vertical bar right here. So I know my position at time t is here. How do I update my information? Well, I take the intersection, this one here. I take the intersection of my prior knowledge based on evolving my initial knowledge and forward in time, and the intersection of that with my new knowledge, which is the random outcome I got under a measurement, and it specifies my new classical state. That specification is a non-deterministic, non-linear, and random, it's non-deterministic and discontinuous classical evolution, just like the collapse of the wave function. Okay, so if we assume that quantum states are epistemic, we get a completely natural explanation of the quantum update rule. And it's just the classical update rule based on Bayesian probability theory. So you have all these beautiful analogies. So the update rule is non-deterministic. I'm out of time, aren't I? Non-deterministic. Okay. Non-deterministic, non-linear, and discontinuous. For some reason, the fact that these properties in quantum mechanics contrast with Schrodinger evolution is a cause for great concern. But the fact that we have the same paradox classically is a cause for no concern. And again, the reason is whether or not you make the assumption in the box. So, another thing that you get is this no cloning theorem quantum mechanically. You can't clone quantum states. Well, you can't clone classical epistemic states either. And it's obvious why. If I have a process that produces a particle and I only know some probabilistic information about that, then given a single sample from that probability distribution, I obviously can't reproduce the full probability distribution. I need an infinite number of samples to get complete information about this probability distribution. Yeah?
What I wanted to ask is that you're very much stressing that all of this is only true if a quantum state is not physical. But what exactly is the problem that quantum state is physical?
Okay, well, you've mischaracterized the argument. I'm not saying this is only true if the quantum state is not physical.
No, okay, the link is only really there if it's not.
What I'm saying is a whole bunch of things that people think are paradoxical are paradoxes that only arise if you assume the quantum state is physical.
What breaks the link between Liouville theory, classical, and quantum mechanics if we assume that, like, it's not because it's physical that it can't change discontinuously, for example.
So if the quantum state is pointed, then the correct classical analogy for it is a phase-space point, right? Because in classical physics, phase-space point is pointed. If the quantum state is epistemic, then the correct analogy for it is the Liouville distribution.
In Liouville, we're also not assuming that there isn't, like, if we're describing a particle, we are assuming that the particle has a position and has a momentum. We just don't know it, which you can also do in quantum mechanics, no?
But sure,
if you have,
that's an interpretation.
A pure state just evolving unitarily, then the point is that you can't make the analogy between that and... The point is to make the analogy between that and the...
Maybe we can set that aside so I can, I only have a few minutes and I need to make a few important points. So what happens is if you calculate the dynamics of the classical expectation values, and here the C means this is a Liouville expectation value, so it's a completely classical object with no mystery, then what you get is essentially almost exactly the same behavior as the quantum one. So normally when you see Ehrenfest's theorem, you see this piece here is a correction to the classical motion. This is a quantum mechanical effect. When we look at Liouville mechanics, because we've broadened our perspective to include the possibility that quantum states are incomplete, then we actually find the same correction to the classical motion. But it's not a quantum correction, it's a classical correction due to incomplete knowledge about the physical properties of the system. And the remarkable thing is you carry this out, it's exactly equivalent to all terms. So here's a little mathematical test for you guys. If I promise you that this equation, if I expand it out to all orders of the Taylor expansion, I get exactly the same expression as the quantum one. Why is quantum dynamics different than classical dynamics? And this is a mathematical question, not a conceptual one. It's a puzzle.
So to clarify, do you mean that this,
you do Schrodinger equation. This is the standard, this is in your undergrad textbook, this expression. But instead of there being a C here, there's no C. And this is a quantum mechanical expectation value. And what I'm saying is you can expand the force function to all orders and you'll get an equivalent expression. The only difference is whether you put a subscript of C next to every expectation value. All right, I don't have much time. So I can't push you to figure this out. The answer is this. These are, how to say it again. These are a pair of coupled differential equations. But when we introduce this term, we can ask, well, what's the time dependence of this object? That's not specified. This is a time-dependent quantity. So to solve these equations, quantum mechanically and classically, I need to also know what's the time dependence of delta Q squared. And I need to figure that out, and delta Q cubed and so on. And then what I'm going to get is I'm going to get an infinite hierarchy of moments. So if we're describing the evolution of a probability density function, we can write down this PDE and solve this PDE via our favorite PDE solver. Or we can write down the hierarchy of moments, truncate the moments at some really high order, and use an ordinary differential equation solver to solve this high number of coupled equations and get the evolution of the moments. And what's going to happen is when you go to higher and higher moments, you're going to start seeing quantum terms sneak in that don't exist in the Liouville expression. Those are the corrections to the classical dynamics. not this. This expression is not in and of itself a correction. You have to look at the higher order terms and you start seeing H bars popping in. And you can see that by using the Vigner-Royale picture. And so if we start talking about comparing quantum mechanics of Hyperion with the classical mechanics of Hyperion, we should be comparing the classical Liouville description of its motion to the quantum one. And then we can ask, do we still see this breakdown? Do we still see this breakdown? And the answer is essentially no. There are very, very small corrections which are essentially unobservable in a chaotic system. So Zurich's claim was wrong on two points. First, he was wrong in that he didn't state his assumption. And this, he was wrong, secondly, in that if you compare to Liouville mechanics, you don't actually need a decoherent story. The statistical difference between the two theories, you would have to prepare Hyperion. I'm sure Matt explained, or you've heard, that to do quantum mechanics, you do a preparation procedure, describe that by a density operator, you do a measurement, you repeat that many times with the same preparation procedure, you collect statistics, you get the quantum probability distribution, the predicted distribution. If the quantum probability distribution differs from the classical distribution by very, very small differences, you have to repeat the experiment millions and millions of times to get good statistical resolution of the probability distribution in order to see those differences. So what we have to do is we have to prepare Hyperion in the same state many, many times, repeat that experiment, let it evolve for 20 years, collect the statistics, and then see if those statistics deviate from the Liouville prediction. Obviously, we can't do that. So this whole story falls apart when you take a different perspective on interpretations. And it's up to you to decide if you think that perspective is correct or not. Let's see if I have some final points to make. Oh, I promised to come back to this idea of objective classical reality. So there's a very nuanced discussion here. Oh, by the way, here's a much, after this, I came up with a much simpler argument. Suppose you have a double well potential. You guys are the first to hear this in a public setting. You have a double well potential, okay? So this is your potential V of Q, and this is Q. And you want to get published in Nature, okay? So what you do is you say, I'm going to prepare this potential. I'm going to show that my system is quantum mechanical, even though it consists of a double well potential I've built out of, what's that stuff kids build stuff out of? That, what? Lego. Not Lego, but that white stuff that you plaster. It's like a plaster.
Play-Doh?
No, it's like a plaster. Come on. You make like a screen mesh and you put plaster on it. Papier-mâché? Yeah, like papier-mâché. So you build this in your basement, okay? You make papier-mâché, all right? And then the ball is like an orange, okay? And you put it right there. And then what you do is your preparation procedure is I drop the ball with my jittery hand, okay? And there's some probability distribution of where the ball is going to fall. And then I say, aha, well, what's the classical trajectory that this ball is going to follow? Okay, this is my equilibrium. My unstable equilibrium is here, unstable equilibrium. Well, classically, we know the trajectory will be this. Now, let me draw the position as a function of time. Here is my unstable equilibrium. Here is the mean of the probability distribution where I'm dropping the orange on the papier-mâché. And then if I have a classical trajectory, it's going to do this. It's going to go, what's up? I'll say that's up. So it's going to go like that, right? Where this is, let's say this point is the extreme point here. Let's call that QE. Okay, and it's going to be almost sinusoidal. It won't. I mean, we're not in the small angle approximation, so it won't be perfectly sinusoidal, but it will be periodic, okay? And that's what you get. And then you say, aha, but my system's quantum mechanical, because when I repeat the experiment many times and I collect the statistics for the mean behavior, what I find is this. The system goes up a bit. The system goes like this. And you say, wow, quantum mechanical effects at the macroscopic scale. All right, because my quantum trajectory is here, and my classical trajectory is here. The quantum trajectory goes like this, up and down the side of the hill. It never comes all the way out to here. What's going on? Well, this isn't a quantum mechanical effect. If I calculate the Liouville, the probability distribution, and some of the trajectories are falling on the other side of my unstable equilibrium point, and notice that a chaotic classical system, the phase space is full of unstable equilibrium points. That's what generates the exponential growth of between different trajectories. So now the classical Liouville motion will also do this. Okay, so if you're going to go around saying that this is a quantum mechanical correction to the classical motion, it's because you haven't given classical mechanics a fair shake. You've used the wrong classical theory because you assume that your wave function is a physical object and that it's that physical object that's going up and down and that that's a non-classical effect. So physics is full of this. Okay, so I'd say most of the things you've heard that are quantum corrections in some settings are actually not even quantum. It's just a classical effect due to thinking about an ensemble behavior rather than a true quantum correction. So when we need to understand the emergence of classicality, we need to raise the bar in terms of what classical theory is and compare quantum mechanics to that bar rather than the low bar of classical properties and classical phase space points. There's one more thing I promised you, which is to explain Habib's story about, suppose you say, well, I don't believe that Hyperion exists. Just because I see it when I look through a telescope doesn't mean it's there before I look. That's how you roll. That's fine. What Habib said is, look, I have this density that's growing this way. You can write down a continuous or quantum state. If you write down a continuous measurement model for a quantum system that's classically chaotic, then what you can show is that the measurement record, the sequence of results I get from my measurement procedure, which involves, say, shining a flashlight on the system, that sequence of results follows a classical chaotic trajectory. So what that shows is that if you're willing to abandon the attempt to explain that there's an external reality that accounts for your observations, you just want quantum mechanics to account for your observations, then you want quantum mechanics to account for your observation of nonlinear trajectories. And in fact, you can get that through a continuous measurement model, where then you look at the eigenvalues you observe through this, you know, sequence of measurements, and that follows a classical trajectory. So that's how you can avoid this whole story. If you want to be a true operationalist, then you don't even have to worry about this stuff. Yeah?
Isn't that kind of like what Nick was getting at earlier, that like if that you should be using a continuous measurement model because there's strong interaction between Hyperion and its environment? Like, so
that's similar.
If
yeah.
You take like if you I don't know if there's anything wrong with this, but like if you say that like some macroscopic object can act as an observer, no matter if it's, you know, like it will conditionally act mm-hmm. based on its interaction, right? Like the planet that Hyperion is orbiting. So like you should be using a continuous measurement model, and then everything's fine. So what's wrong with that explanation?
There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with thinking that you're living in the matrix either, right? If you want to believe that you're in the matrix, you can. If you want to,
but that's not the same. Like you can think that there is an objective, like planet and moon, and the planet is like a macroscopic object interacting as an observer.
Okay, let me just stop you there, because I've had this discussion many times. What does it mean to say, I believe that there's an objective property out there that I'm measuring, but I'm not going to claim that the value, the numerical value I assign to that property, has anything to do with the property I observe, the numerical value I obtain upon measurement? I mean, it's a vacuous statement. You're saying, oh yeah, I only want to believe that what matters is my measurement results, but I'm not going to go so far as to say that it doesn't exist. I do believe it exists. Well, you're believing it exists, but you're denying that its properties have anything to do with the properties you've measured. That seems to me odd. Like, either you go full Monty and you say, look, yes, it has properties, and in fact, those are the properties that I observe through measurement, or you say, no, it has properties, the properties have nothing to do with what I measure, and then it's a vacuous statement to say that it exists and has properties. I mean,
yeah, but the only thing he's saying is that macroscopic stuff measures everything that's
beside the point.
But in the case of Hyperion, it's not like the interaction isn't even like that. If you just considering the gravitational interaction, it's like the electron proton system, and then the interact, you know, an electron in an energy eigenstate is coherent. Like the interaction between the proton and the electron doesn't destroy that.
Yeah, that's exactly the right point.
It doesn't observe.
The point is the
gravitational interaction won't destroy
a
coherent state of the moon in one of its orbitals.
It's an equivalent description quantum mechanically to assume that this big heavy object, Saturn, is just creating an external potential that the other particle is moving around in. It's mathematically equivalent. So we can think about it that way, and it's not decohering it, as Matt said. So it's not helping us understand this problem. It's, in my view, it's a red herring, thinking about that. What's more relevant is the person looking through the telescope who sees the position of Hyperion at some time and wants to create a story about explaining their observations. And so I would challenge you on that view that you want to, I mean, this is the same challenge I have for Chris Fuchs, is that what does it mean to say that objective properties exist but to not correlate them with the properties you observe? It ends up being a shallow notion of external reality.
Yeah, like maybe the picture of quantum, like of the quantum world that I have is actually just like self inconsistent. But like I would be inclined to think that like what it means to make a measurement is to have the actions of one subsystem be conditional upon the actions of another, and like that collapse or whatever would be some emergent property of like a system with macroscopic number of degrees of freedom that are interacting. And I'm wondering if that is like a possible view. Like, do people hold that view, or is that not allowed by like? Is that not allowed? Do you know what I mean?
I'm not sure that answered the question. Matt, do you want to?
I mean, I think people hold that view. I just don't think. I mean, it's like if you say a microscopic quantum system has no properties on its own, right? It only has properties through interaction with some macroscopic system. That macroscopic system is composed also of a bunch of microscopic systems. So, you know, okay, so we know cases of emergence where you can have a property like temperature emerge from bunch of molecules bumping into each other and stuff like that, but here you're trying to say that something real emerges from something which has no reality. So I don't see how that can be a case of emergence. How can you get properties from something which has no properties? Right. So I don't see how they.
Why is it necessary that the microscopic things have no properties?
No, the microscopic things. I thought the argument was.
Well, I mean, if they do have properties, then you know we're in a realist picture and
yeah, like I'm cool with that,
right? And if you're cool with that, fine.
Okay.
But the any real properties that you ascribe to a macroscopic system have to somehow be derived from properties of the microscopic system. So the problem is to say, well, what are those properties of the microscopic system? And of course, in this kind of anti-realist approach, people don't ascribe any such properties.
Is there a way to have such an emergence? For example, if I have two spins, two one-off spins, and I put them in a Bell state of being up down or down up, then there is no objective property of one or the other spin of being up or down, but there is an objective property of the two spins being one up and one down.
Well, if you believe in orthodox interpretation, I mean, if you believe in the connection between probability one and, you know, basically the EPR criterion, right? So then you can say that. Sure, but how does that help you?
What's an objective property if not something that has probability one? What does it mean for something to be an objective property?
You're being an operationalist, right? You're saying the only criteria I'm going to
accept. I'm just asking for a definition.
The only criteria I'm going to accept for reality is if I can predict in an experiment I can do with probability one, something will happen, then I'm prepared to call that an objective property. That's the only definition I've ever seen.
No, you're missing the point. You're missing the point. It's not, you're missing the causal order here. It's not that. It's, if it's a property, then I get probability one. There's I'm not saying this right, but it's a necessary versus a sufficient condition that you guys are disagreeing on.
Right.
Like Matt's saying,
imagine that the entire universe is exactly in thermal equilibrium at some temperature T, right? So, but we're in the heat death of the universe, right? Then it's still the case that all the particles in the universe have a definite position, right? But there's no measurement that you'd ever do to detect that position in that universe, right? That there would never be a point at which you could predict with probability one where a particle is, just because you wouldn't have the ability to create such a measuring device in a universe that was exactly in thermal equilibrium. You really can't do anything in such a universe. So everything that you would see in such a universe would look completely random, and it would look like, you know, if you applied the criterion that only when I predict probability one, I'm prepared to ascribe the property, then you'd say, well, I can't ascribe any properties in this.
I'm not saying that's necessarily true. I'm just asking for another definition.
No, you're missing the point. You're missing the point. Here's the point you're missing. Two people. Person A says, I only accept that something is real if there's probability one of predicting it.
Stop.
Person two says, I accept that something is real if I can predict probability one, but I also accept that other things are real, which I cannot predict with probability one.
What does real mean?
What is objective reality?
What is that? It's a model.
It's a model. It's a model for explaining our observations. Okay.
And we gave the definition that we were using it when we're talking about ontological model. It's just that we believe that there are some physical properties out there and that they're correlated with what we see somehow. And we ascribe a joint probability distribution to all that.
Okay, you can define an objective property as, in an operational view, as something which you can predict with probability one.
Sure.
That's a definition, a mathematical thing I can write down. And I'm just saying that outside that, there can be other views, but I've never seen a definition like that. What does it mean to be an objective property?
It means that the theory on a particular reading says that this thing in the mathematical formalism corresponds to something that exists out there, right?
Hold on,
let me just interrupt. I can explain to you what you're missing later, but there was another question.
Yeah. I have a more advanced question.
So does Liouville mechanics say anything about a double slit experiment, for example?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right, Liouville mechanics would give you the double slit result without the interference fringe. So the interference fringe would be a quantum mechanical effect, and the Liouville description is kind of what's implicit in when you compare the quantum and classical cases there. And that's an interesting question too, because in the question of emergence of classicality is, under what condition do we lose this interference fringe? What does it take? And the usual story is decoherence. But it turns out people that have done these macroscopic examples or mesoscopic examples of the double slit, like the C60 molecules, what they found, the hardest part to see the interference fringe wasn't getting rid of decoherence. It was being able to resolve the details of the interference fringe and create a grating that was small enough to create the interference fringe. So in order to take a buckyball and see an interference fringe, they had to create a grating, which was a controlled experiment with a grating on the scale of 100 nanometers. For this C60 particle to create an interference fringe. And the interference fringe itself was like 100 micrometers. So in other words, the challenge for seeing quantum effects had nothing to do with decoherence, but had to do with creating the precision required to make it manifest and see the effects for such a large object, because the de Broglie wavelength goes inversely with mass of the object. And so the structural scales to manifest interference require controlled structure on a scale that goes gets small really fast for big systems. Any other questions?
I mean, the reason I asked that was because in some epistemological models, like Rob Speckens, you can apparently describe interferences with these models. So I thought there was maybe a direct connection.
Yeah, there is a connection. So you can get interference-like effects. I think the double slit experiment itself, though, because it's a continuous model, I don't know if there's a story there.
There is a connection here, which is that some versions of the Speckens-Tweed theory can be derived from Liouville mechanics, but not just Liouville mechanics, I'm saying it's Liouville mechanics with a restriction on the probability distributions you could prepare. So, you know, you do get the equations of Louisville mechanics, but you don't say, you know, you have to have like this sort of knowledge balance principle type of idea. And so, you know, you only get certain kinds of probability distributions, and you own, and the interaction between the distribution and the measurement device creates a disturbance, but it doesn't have to happen in standard Louisville mechanics. And so it's those sort of additional effects, the disturbance that comes from having to maintain this restricted set of probability distributions, that allows you to get interference effects. Now, it's true that in a continuous system, as far as I know, you can get some qualitative interference effects. You can't get the exact double slit interference pattern. So, you know, it's more like the Max Ender type of stuff that I talked about. So it's kind of like, there's a certain amount of apparently quantum phenomena that comes just from making an analogy between quantum state and probability distribution. But then if you want to get more, then you have to add extra restriction.
Anything else, or should we wrap it up?
We wrap it up.
Okay, thanks for your attention.